The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with writer Marlise Kastmeyer's article about her and her husband's quest for Swiss citizenship culminates in a sojourn to the Alps. Now, this article was written for the Tribune News Service and appeared in the June 9, 2024 online edition of the News and Observer. Let us begin. It was a check-the-box trip. One intended to fill our quota to earn my husband possible Swiss citizenship. With dual nationality, I'm fortunate enough to hold the coveted red passport due to my family bloodline. Having spent my mid-20s in the Alps, I tucked the notion in my mind that perhaps one day my husband could also carry one of the world's most powerful passports. Easier said than done. After 12 years of marriage, we started with the initial paperwork, followed by an essay in German as to why he wanted to become a Swiss citizen. During the process, we delivered a library's worth of documents, ranging from financial reports to letters of recommendation. Next were in-person interviews at the nearest Swiss consulate, which happened to be in San Francisco. Thus, we flew from our home in San Diego for verbal test, again in German. After hours of studying, plus spending thousands in application fees, there was no turning back. The good news was we passed almost every phase. The bad news was that we hadn't visited Switzerland enough to prove our allegiance. The fact that the pandemic had closed travel didn't matter. We had to make 3 trips over 5 years. This meant we were 1 trip short of hopefully waving the White Cross flag. And so we packed our bags, adopting the mindset that this trip would double as a spring skiing getaway during our qualifying trial. 7 days would introduce us to the French municipality of Crone, Montana, Valais, and reconnect us with our familiar friend Zermatt in the German-speaking district of Visp. Now, Swiss Airlines landed us in Zurich, where we caught a train to our first destination at Crone, Montana. Now, the Swiss Travel System, STS, left little need to rent a car, since a Swiss Travel Pass granted us unlimited travel by train, bus, and boat. I had once lived just 2 hours away in the village of Gstaad, yet there wasn't too much I knew about Crone, Montana. Now, some 20 years later, I returned as the prodigal child, clinging to my roots so I could build new ones. Although my family tree had branched from Swiss heritage, there was still something purely impartial about the culture. Locals had a deep love for nature, family, and order. There was rarely conflict because, frankly, there was nothing to argue about. Switzerland was a harmonious nation, cliched for chocolate, cowbells, and cheese. These lures aside, there was a respect for the land and one's neighbor. We felt it in Crone, Montana, where 4 municipalities joined forces to unveil a twin town nirvana in 2017. As recent as it was, the Burnet magic started back in 1893 with 2 besties, Louis Antille and Michel Zuffere. Now, together, they climbed from the valley to the mountaintop to open the area's first hotel, Hotel Du Parc. Now, the region soon gained notoriety from doctors who prescribed patients the area's air quality and later from the world's best golfers during the 1983 European Masters. While it was the sunshine and sky that lured these pioneers, it was the 1987 World Ski Championships that officially put the destination on the map. And now we were on that map, tracking it with apps wide open for everything it had to offer, starting with Hostellerie du Pas Levier De Louvre, I should say, excuse me. Now, this Relay and Chateau property had me at sheepskin rugs. I'm a sucker for refined coziness, and this boutique hotel nailed it with in-room fireplaces, heated floors, private jacuzzis, stone walls, and timber-beamed ceilings. Sinking my jet-lagged feet into plush slippers, I exhaled and asked my husband the inevitable question. I wonder what property cost here. We often do that, escape to land void of troubles, tasks, and to-dos, and wonder if it's the place. And without answering, my husband pulled back the curtains to unveil the moonlit peaks. He nodded. I think our dogs would love it here. What was not to love? Within walking distance of our chalet, the ski resort boasted 87 miles of trails, a 10,000-foot summit, and $50 lift tickets. From the top, a chain of peaks pierced through a duvet of clouds, revealing the Valais Alps from the Matterhorn to Mont Blanc. To get a lay of the land, we hired a ski guide who took us on wide, curving pistes, down untouched bowls, and along seven-mile runs that made our thighs burn. In rudimentary French, I asked him why there were no people on the mountain. He explained that lift lines and swarmed slopes were basically non-existent, especially come spring when locals traded skis for hiking boots and snowboards for bikes. With nearly the whole mountain to ourselves, we pushed to pause for lunch at La Cabane de Violette. The stone mountain hut takes gourmet cuisine to the next level, literally. At 7,000 feet, the restaurant serves traditional temptations, la côte de fromage, bubbling cheese toast, and rosti, grated potato cake with sausage and white asparagus. Between breakfast croissants and a hearty lunch, you'd think we'd had our fill of food for the day, but lo and behold, we were in wine country. For an introduction to the blends of Valais, we went straight to the source, Cave de la Tamboline Winery. Now, run by second-generation winemakers Ishmael and Madeleine Bonvin, the winery popped the cork in 1987. Today, it's producing over 30,000 bottles of 20 award-winning wines. From the cellar, Madeleine dusted off 6 bottles, pairing them with platters of local cheeses, cured meats, and artisan chocolate to boot. She credited the Rhone Valley's Mediterranean climate for part of their success in this sun-drenched region of 300 wineries, producing robust reds, aromatic whites, and fruity rosés. Believe it or not, we had fondue that night, but the fact that we had to work for it justified the, gluttonous consumption. At full moon, hiking from the neighboring village of Amona to the Hamlet is a must. It was our guide, Marl Ne Galetti, who greeted us with snowshoes, hiking poles, headlamps, and a blue heeler ready to rumble. A former thriving ski town, Amona seemed frozen in time, a ghostly relic of its bustling past dating to 1968. Now, development plans have wavered, and it currently serves as a gateway for hiking, cross-country skiing, and mountain biking. From the muddy trailhead, we learned of Marl's Ney's background as a cheesemaker and herbologist. She had traveled the world, sharing homesteading secrets with communities, seeking to live off the land. Naturally, I asked her about everything from homemade sunscreen to longevity tinctures, that is, until she pointed toward the horizon. That single moment silenced us all. A full moon overshadowed the mountains, so pink you'd swear they were blushing. We continued to climb, the quiet only broken by the sound of the snow crunching beneath our crampons. And then there it was, Colombelles-la-Hameau. A hamlet of clustered mayans, these traditional stone and wooden chalets, function as summer homes for farmers who reside upstairs and keep livestock below. With keys to the kingdom, Marlna opened the door to Mayen and put us to work. Together, the three of us cooked cheese fondue and with boiled potatoes, pearl onions, and cornicons. Now, after a meal like that, we wished we had selected the return sledding option. Instead, we hiked under the moonlight, stopping only once to admire a yellow coltsfoot flower pushing through the snow in determination. puncturing the surrounding crust with her pole. Marlna scraped away a layer of snow as if giving the flower space to breathe. There was something remarkable about that moment, a hint of spring beckoning and the sprouting seeds to burst forth in a mighty super bloom. As much as I'd like to talk about the shopping, it was only while walking with Rue de Prado that I noticed boutiques selling luxury brands like Hermes, Mont Blanc, and Chopard. There are nearly 200 shops rounding out the local attractions of 200-plus miles of hiking, biking trails, 7 lakes, 4 golf courses, 3 museums, 130 restaurants, 12 historical villages, and 4 waterfalls. But who's counting numbers, or calories, when you can eat mountain huts and Michelin-starred restaurants? Wow. Well, alas, we indulged again, this time to Le Bistro des Oies, in the cellar of our hotel, with a mountain-inspired menu courtesy of Franck Renault. Now, the Michelin-starred chef uses only Swiss ingredients in his French Mediterranean cuisine. If time allowed, we will have dined there again with a smattering of paragliding, dog sledding, chocolate tasting, yak hiking, and maybe even heli-skiing, rather. Needless to say, we weren't ready to leave Crans-Montana, but Zermatt and budget had us locked in for part 2 of the trip. From our hotel, we caught a morning bus to Chaumont, followed by a train to Visp, peppering a patchwork of fields and vineyards where darling chalets as perfect as if God had sprinkled cuckoo clocks from heaven. Going from French to German required some brain activation. Suddenly, with that first greeting of Grazie, I felt like I was home. It was my 4th trip to Zermatt, but still, the fact that village travel was by foot, bike, or electric taxi was remarkable. Until the 1980s, the vehicle-free village of Zermatt relied on horse-drawn carriages. Despite these changes, the sound of clopping and cobblestone could be heard echoing throughout the narrow streets of Hinterdorf. Dating to the 16th century, this historic zone has barns and stables constructed from larch trees in the traditional style, balancing on stilts with slate roofs, rickety stepladders, and timber-cornered notching. At its center is a memorial fountain paying tribute to Ulrich Endebinden, who climbed the Matterhorn 370 times. We, too, would be approaching that mountain, or rather its base, via the comfort of a chairlift. Getting there was easy, with direct access to the slopes from Hotel Servo. What Pas de Loures was to elegance, Servo was to design. Now, remodeled in 2020, the stylish property has just 54 rooms housed with 7 chalets. With tweed, wool, and leather textiles, our room teased hipster huntsman meets polished mountaineer. Now, private ski lockers, an honesty bar, a live DJ, and a climbing wall checked all the boxes. Beauty was in the details, with medicine bottles filled with dried flowers below deer mounts reminding us of where we were. Oh, and the ice bath helped solidify that fact, a chilly awakening after the sauna, steam bath, and relaxation yurt. This mountain ashram was the main draw for my husband, while its proximity to the slopes had me on speed dial. From our hotel, an elevator took us through the mountain to the starting point of Europe's highest ski resort. Rails, escalators, gondolas, and chairlifts revealed a mind-blowing feat of engineering and infrastructure that covered 324 miles across 2 countries. As we skied our way toward Italy, I asked my husband if we needed passports. What a trip that must be. Well, from the sojourn in the Alps, we're going to head next to Texas, where writer Jenny Randolph is going to explain why Fort Worth is so important to the future of self-driving technology. Now, her article originally appeared in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and also was published in the June 3, 2024 online edition of the News and Observer. And I need to make a correction. The date should be June 3, 2023, not 24. Now, for anyone who likes to complain about North Texas drivers, it might sound alarming to know that soon you'll be sharing the highways with transport trucks that don't have a driver at all. The Metroplex has quietly become a new frontier for the development of autonomous trucking, with several companies from around the world setting up operations here and using North Texas highways for real-world testing. For now, these delivery trucks making stops at Sam's Clubs, Kroger's, and other destinations do have a human being behind the wheel, a safety driver in case of emergencies or technology glitches. Soon, that will no longer be the case. The worsening shortage of people to fill trucking jobs is fueling a race among companies to bring to market a dominant driverless technology for the future of moving goods on the nation's highways. Several of the largest industry players are now in North Texas, lured by the region's central location of the transportation network and the state's looser regulations. But that also has some experts worried about just how safe driverless trucks really are, given the technology is so new. An added concern for North Texas is that the companies are testing their trucks on highways here. Next section starts with Fort Worth, a new hub for autonomous trucking. In Fort Worth's near Southside neighborhood, Volvo Autonomous Solutions, a division of the Swedish car manufacturer, opened an office in April 2023 focused on commercializing, selling, and delivering autonomous solutions globally. The office at 401 Bryan Avenue will start Volvo's U.S. highway activities aimed at transporting goods to and from customer hubs on long-haul trucks. In partnership with self-driving technology company Aurora, Volvo plans to get a fleet of delivering on lane between Fort Worth and El Paso, on one lane, I should say, between those two cities, and another between Dallas and Houston. Now, to the north, Alliance, Texas, is home to a mobility innovation zone, which allows for the testing, scaling, and commercialization of new technologies. Experts say the zones, Fort Worth a shot at becoming the Silicon Valley of mobility and innovation. Autonomous deliverer Gatik explained to Alliance in mid-2021 where it operates a research and development facility and North Texan operation hubs. Now, with offices in Canada and California, Gatik specializes in middle-mile deliveries of up to 300 miles round trip. Gatik's self-driving trucks deliver to more than 30 Sam's Club locations in the Metroplex. It recently went live with Kroger, moving goods from customer fulfillment centers to grocery stores across North Texas. Alliance is also home to self-driving trucking companies, Too Simple, based in San Diego, and Swedish company Unride. Meanwhile, Google subsidiary Waymo is testing self-driving trucks on Interstate 45 between Fort Worth and Houston, and California-based Kodiak Robotics operates most of its self-driving operations out of Dallas. Next section starts with why are all the key players coming to North Texas? Ian Kenney, Director of Logistics Innovation at Alliance Texas developer Hillwood, said Texas has been the prove-it state for the industry. Kenney says he thinks the state wants to understand the technology and work with these companies to help them commercialize. DFW, that stands for Dallas-Fort Worth, has really become the spot for autonomous trucking in the U.S., Kenney said. Texas is attracted to these companies because of its limited regulation and because a lot of freight is already moving on its highways. Texas does not require autonomous trucks to have a safety driver, but Kenney said most companies still use one to promote safety in the remote chance an issue occurs. Kenney said safety is the first thing many of the autonomous trucking companies talk about, and he said wide-scale adoption of autonomous driving will be a gradual process. While some states have different rules on testing and deploying autonomous trucks, Texas is very hands-off on regulation, experts say. Texas's regulatory environment means we could see more of these trucks on our roads. But that's concerning to Philip Koopman, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, who has been working on self-driving car safety for more than 25 years. Autonomous trucking companies decide for themselves when they think their vehicles are safe enough to operate on public roads, Koopman said. The government probably made that decision for jobs and economic growth, Koopman said, but the cost of that decision is you're potentially putting other road users at risk, and there's no way to figure out how safe it is. That's the trade-off that's been made. Koopman said companies face tremendous pressure to get on the road, show progress, and maintain investment of stakeholders. One hopes the companies are responsible, Koopman said. Some have proven they are. Some have proven they are not. Under the kind of financial pressure, even the best leadership might find themselves with pressure to deploy, even if they're not ready. That's a tough position to be in, he said. Koopman said he would prefer to see external oversight that would relieve that pressure on companies to decide when it's safe to remove the driver from behind the wheel. Next section, how do self-driving trucks work? While companies' techniques in mastering autonomous trucking vary, there are some common overlaps. Many companies use computer mapping to plan the path of a self-driving truck. In the case of Volvo, sensors log data while driving on a road that helps a computer understand the surroundings. Karen Wind, the head of marketing and communications for Volvo Autonomous Solutions, said the company can then simulate pop-up scenarios that would change road conditions. These include construction zones, weather and obstacles like animals, or the occasional pedestrian. We repeatedly train the virtual driver and hardware on these difficult scenarios and validate the results with real-world driving so we know that the vehicle will behave safely in these situations, Wynn said. Meanwhile, Gaddix trucks are in continual two-way communication with the company's remote monitoring centers. Richard Steiner, Gaddix head of policy and communications, said from there, employees monitor the fleet and can provide remote assistance if there is a lane closure or unexpected construction. Gaddix remote supervision system has been developed to leverage human intuition, which ensures our autonomous fleet remains fundamentally independent while safeguarding certain advantages of human-to-vehicle collaboration, Steiner said. While maps do a lot of the heavy lifting, they're not necessarily foolproof, experts say. Self-driving expert Koopman said one problem is making sure frequently changing construction zones get updated on computer maps. People will say they're going to put all the construction zones on a map, but the first vehicle to see a construction zone doesn't know it's there, Koopman said. That can help other vehicles after the first one, but if that first vehicle is an automated truck and it doesn't know how construction zone works, you've got a problem. One thing Koopman is not worried about is autonomous trucks merging and changing lanes. Most companies have spent considerable time teaching their vehicles to merge with the right amount of assertiveness based on the culture of the city to match prevailing traffic conditions, he said. Koopman does worry about unusual things that happen on the ride, like overturned vehicles, bicyclists, crossing animals, grass fires, and emergency vehicles. While the industry promotes safety, Koopman argues, there is not tangible proof or data to support autonomous trucks being safer than human drivers. They could be safer. I'd be delighted if they were, but we don't know, Koopman said. We can't set policies assuming they're safer because there's no data. Despite his safety reservations, Koopman acknowledged the U.S. trucking industry's labor shortage is a legitimate reason to pursue autonomous technology. The American Trucking Association's estimated shortage of nearly 78,000 drivers last year projects the shortage could surpass 160,000 drivers by 2030. Meanwhile, leaders across the country affirm safety is their main priority. And while North Texans trucks may still have a safety driver inside the vehicle, that's not the case everywhere. And next section, the final section, how soon will we see trucks without a human driver? Before coming to North Texas, Gaddix began operations with food retailer Loblaw in Canada, and it went fully driverless last year. The company also began commercial operations with Walmart in Arkansas, where the retailer is based, in June 2019. Gaddix pulled the safety driver out of his trucks in August 2021, Steiner said. Safety is table stakes, front and center of everything we do, Steiner said. It runs deep within the fabric of the company. We always commence operations with a safety driver on board for safety, validation, and verification purposes as we ramp up towards driver out of every single new route. Now, it took about 2 years to go driver out in Arkansas and about 19 months to go driver out in Canada, Steiner said. As we ramp up towards driver out with our customers in Texas, that timeline will continue to shrink, Steiner said. Steiner said Gaddix is looking to remove drivers from vehicles in North Texas by 2024. Volvo's Sasko Kutleff, head of on-road solutions, could only say his company is getting close. We don't have all the answers, Kutleff said. There is a transformation ongoing. We, of course, want to be part of that, but also learn along the way what is feasible and what is not. Cutliff says the race is not necessarily to be the first on the road, but rather to develop an industrialized, safe, and scalable solution that's commercially viable. Volvo has an ambition to be one of the winners here, Cutliff says. Everything we do has safety in mind, and we'll never compromise that, he said. Well, we're going to conclude by reading an excerpt from China Blackman's article, From a Treehouse to a Castle, The 10 Coolest Airbnbs in North Carolina. This article, written for the Charlotte Observer and appearing in the November 5th, 2024 online edition of the News and Observer. And it begins with this introduction. Whether you want a relaxing beach vacation or an adventurous mountain getaway, North Carolina is home to some pretty popular destinations. When you're booking a trip, of course, it's all about the location. But sometimes the beauty of a vacation getaway can also be in where you stay, not just the place you visit. If you want to switch things up for your accommodations, there are dozens of cozy cabins and luxurious beach houses across the state you can book a trip with, and several over-the-top places you can stay in, too. Now, we did some research and sifted through Airbnb's unique stays in North Carolina. This included the OMG home category of the quirkiest, most mind-bending vacation rentals, and these are our favorites. From a sky-high treehouse to a private castle, there are 10 extraordinary Airbnb rentals across the state, and we'll briefly describe these. There's the 1933 Little Red Caboose in Andrews, North Carolina. This cost $139 a night for three guests, one bedroom, two beds, and a bath. And take a trip back in time to the 1930s and experience staying in a Little Red Caboose in Andrews, the Airbnb listing says. It's one-of-a-kind, fully renovated Southern Railway caboose located on two riverfront acres with stunning mountain and valley views. Then we have the 80s arcade and bedroom located in Winston-Salem. Now, this costs $275 a night. It comes with two double beds and a bathroom. Your totally awesome bedroom at the 80s arcade is 80s themed with a private entrance. The 80s arcade is the largest private collection on the East Coast, the Airbnb listing says. Whether you're an 80s kid or just an 80s junkie, you swear you've traveled back in time to the 80s. Next, we have the Barbie Dream House in Raleigh. Now, this costs $86 a night. There's six guests, three bedrooms, three beds, one bath. From the moment you walk in, you'll be surrounded by the iconic Barbie aesthetic with glamorous decor and dazzling lighting, the Airbnb says. Then we have the gas station cabin at Union Mills, North Carolina. This cost $195 a night with two guests, one bedroom, one bed, and one bath. Special gas station touches throughout the cabin. Some old gas cans, original gas pumps out front, and a private trail to take to a large lake with fishing opportunities. Next is the Hobbit Henge in Weaverville, North Carolina. Now, this cost $127 a night, three guests, one bedroom, one bed, and a half bath. Then there's the luxury condo at Charlotte Motor Speedway in Concord. This is $303 a night, four guests, two bedrooms, three beds, two baths. Then we have the off-the-grid treehouse in Fletcher, North Carolina for $138 a night. And next we have the Midnight, night spelled K-N-I-G-H-T, the Midnight Bus in Hayesville, North Carolina. This is the hustle and bustle of reality as you cross a wooden bridge and step onto the grounds of some of the best-loved fairy tale stories. Then we have a private castle in Spruce Pine for $2,500 a night. That's for 16 guests. And finally, the Treetop Teepee in Marshall, North Carolina for $124 a night. There you go. Lots of fun, and I'm afraid that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.